Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest political affairs forum. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist and author of All America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots, and I'll be your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. This meeting is on the Arab Spring, its origins and its continuing aftermath, and we have four distinguished panelists. First is Noor Ahmadine, an Egyptian student activist. He's born and raised in Cairo, and he recently graduated from the University of San Francisco. His passion lies in liberation technology and how developing countries can utilize different technological initiatives in order to gain greater transparency and strive towards democracy. After the Arab Spring, he co-founded the group Yalla Students in Solidarity. Maher Khaleji is a British Jordanian academic. Born and raised in Amman, Jordan, Dr. Khaleji earned his PhD in chemistry at Great Britain's Southampton University before returning to Jordan for military service. Back in the United Kingdom, he became head of the School of Chemistry at Bangor University in Wales. And throughout his academic career, he's traveled extensively and established academic links, including to the Middle East and North Africa. Before moving to the United States as an independent consultant and to oversee a startup company. Abbas Milani is director of Iranian studies at Stanford University and is the author most recently of The Shah. He has been one of the founding co-directors of the Iran Democracy Project and a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. Dr. Milani has published more than 20 books and 200 articles and book reviews in scholarly journals, magazines, journals, and newspapers, including Middle East Journal, the New York Review of Books, and the Times Literary Supplement. And his work has been translated into many languages, including Arabic. Until 1986, Dr. Milani taught at Tehran University's Faculty of Law and Political Science. And our fourth panelist is Janet Penley, an American traveler who experienced the center of Arab protests when she arrived in Cairo on December 28, 2010. Ms. Penley traveled in Egypt, Jordan, and Syria for the better part of the next month. Ms. Penley is retired from a financial services career and currently teaches photography classes at City College Extension. So we have four people, four different vantage points. The Arab Spring, of course, is the continuing series of momentous protests across the Arab world that have led to the removal of Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, Tunisian President Ben Ali, a civil war in Libya that now involves NATO and the United States and threatens to topple Muammar Gaddafi, and massive protests in Syria, Yemen, Bahrain, and elsewhere. Despite Mubarak's removal, the Egyptian military is still firmly in control, and protesters have returned to Tahrir Square to press for more pronounced changes in Egypt. Other Arab capitals have witnessed similar ongoing protests. A recent headline in the Associated Press put it this way: Arab Spring hardens into summer of stalemates as challenge of changing regimes becomes clearer. Let's begin this panel by having each of the panelists speak briefly about their thoughts on the Arab Spring and their personal views on what has happened and might happen still. Let's begin with Noor Ahmadine.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here. I'm recovering from a cold. I won't get anybody sick, but I'm recovering. So in terms of the Arab Spring, this may be an egocentric way to think about it because I am an Egyptian citizen, but the way I generally like to think of it, and I think many Arabs as well, is Egypt is a very good insight or kind of window into what's happening in the rest of the Arab world. There were been times where if the momentum in Egypt had slowed down, I firmly believe you would have been seeing that happening in neighboring countries. And what's happening right now in Egypt now has been transcending through all borders, starting in Tunisia and been going on and not stopping. And the one thing I would really like to point out, being an Egyptian and now living here, studying here 4 years, and making a conscious choice right now of whether I'm going to go back and work there or not, the revolution has employed a lot of people, but also taken a lot of people out of business. The number one thing I really want to stress is that it's not instantaneous. If we look across the board in every revolution that's ever happened, and this is very unique because you've never seen a concentration, or rarely ever have you seen a concentration of revolutions happening in countries so close by. Usually they're in distant places, different cultures, different ideologies, different religions, everything. And now very similar across the board, and it's hitting everywhere. It's infectious on a human level. And the one thing I really like to stress is that it's not going to be overnight. I have my Egyptian friends, I have my foreign friends, I have everybody, a lot of people are very hopeful for it. Of course you have the cynical people, the skeptics, but I personally am very hopeful for it, but because it's not overnight. The way I like to think of it, people think, oh, when did the revolution really start happening? Or when did the revolution, what's this next phase that we're going into? Like a disaster, you have the post-emergency response phase, which lasts a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, where things are very volatile, fragile. And then you have the transition into rebuilding the economy, all that stuff. Well, this is not the same case. It's not a disaster. It's very fragile. It's going to take years to come. So my question basically is, when does a revolution really end? When are we going to see this kind of come down to an end? People are going to be taken to Tahrir Square. So I left Egypt 2 days before the revolution. Oh, it burned me inside to leave Egypt. I was like, oh, I want to be there so badly. Came out here and then really struggled with myself. My roommate over there too, he's Egyptian, and we asked ourselves every single day, I want to go back. I want to go back. I want to go back. At first we felt so helpless and then confused, then a little bit scared when the internet went down and all of that. And then we asked ourselves, we're like, we can almost be more effective out here than we can back there. So, yeah, basically that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Nora. Let's go to Maher Kalaji. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Okay, I've been monitoring what's been going on in the Middle East for quite a while. And I started making notes about a couple of days ago, but then things are moving at a tremendous pace. I mean, I just looked today at some of the headline news. Libyan rebels claim Brega victory. Egypt TV to show officials' trials. UAE activists pleaded not guilty. Syria protesters released in Hama. Opposition quits Bahrain talks. Boy shot in Tunisia protest. Hosni Mubarak, coma claim denied. Police held over Jordan clashes. News have changed a lot from the Middle East. It never used to be like this. It used to be quite boring and monotone. Things have changed. There are 22 Arab countries. We've had 5 uprisings in Tunisia, in Libya, Egypt, Syria, and Yemen. We've had one country with major clashes followed by a clampdown in Bahrain. There have been other small stirrings of dissent in countries like Jordan, Oman, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Algeria. The thing is, as my colleague said here, is there's no size that fits all. We were all expecting it to just crumble like a domino. This has not happened. Okay? And the more you look at it, the more you realize that the Arab world does not behave as one homogeneous block. Okay? It doesn't behave like this any more than Europe does. Okay? So it's thousands of different shades of gray or green. I think it's better to call it red at the moment because of blood that's being spilled there. And I think the region is the richer for this because of this diversity. Now, the events have been going on at an absolutely stunning speed. And I don't know who coined the phrase the Arab Spring, but it stuck. Now we're in a blazing summer. Okay? The change seems to be taking its time. It's not quick. It's not easy. It's painful. Thousands have died. Others are still in prison. We have a civil war in Libya. We have a government that uses lethal force in Syria, although they deny it. Bahrain is an interesting one. And the whole conflict in the region has developed into something which in certain countries have become a bit nasty and bitter. Okay? Before it was different. We had people who were revolting against tyrants. They were going against governments for economic policies, for corruption. But now, because there are so many fingers in the pie, there's sectarianism appearing in there, and ethnicity is beginning to appear in there. There's a very good article in the on one of the BBC websites by Jeremy Bowen, and he said, he quotes, "What happened may be one of history's full stops." That's a period in American. Okay? Hopefully it's not. Okay? Hopefully things are changing. And I think, and I believe what he says is that the change will be measured in years, generations, and not seasons. Okay? So it's not spring or summer. I think things will take time before we start moving forward. We can't turn the clock back. That's important. Okay? I think the pressure in the whole region is driven by two factors at the moment. And one of them is the demography of the region. Demographically, the Arab world, 60% of the population is under 30. Okay. That's huge. That's a huge proportion. I've got a list here. I won't bore you with it. I made a list of the average age in the Arab world, particularly in the countries where we have some conflicts at the moment. Yemen, for example, the average age is 17.9 years. Okay? Egypt, 24. They're quite mature in there. Jordan is 21.8. Libya is... I don't think there's a figure for Libya. There's 24, actually, for Libya. Syria is 21.5. The oldest I think I've got is Tunisia, 29.7. But the rest, you know, it's under 30. 60% of the population is under 30. And they cannot accept the status quo as it is. Things have gone far too far for them. So that they're fed up with the status quo, they want change to happen in the region. There's another important factor which also Jeremy Bowen highlights. And I think it relates to something else, but the important thing is that the West no longer believe, including the US, cannot believe that it's a decisive factor in the region. I can't remember who wrote an article recently, but they said the president of the United States cannot anymore lift the telephone and call the president of Egypt, for example, and say, "I want you to rein in Hamas." Okay? Things have changed. This guy will, in a few years' time, say, "Sorry, I have an election to look forward to. I cannot do what you're asking me to do." So there has been a tectonic plate shift in the region. It really is tectonic. And you can't go back on what has happened. I think it will take time. We're only 6 months since the first incidents that happened in Tunisia and Egypt. I try to compare this with what happened in Eastern Europe. People say, "Oh, look what's happened in Eastern Europe." Although it was mainly peaceful. It started in November, I think it was November 1989 in Poland with the Solidarity Movement in Gdansk. But then it took a few years. Some of them were peaceful, but Erich Honecker in East Germany had a shoot-to-kill policy on anybody who demonstrated. Okay. So things are shaping to a similar effect as what happened in Eastern Europe. And if you look at it, the last countries to change were Albania and Yugoslavia, 1991-1992. The collapse of the Soviet Union into the different Latvia, Moldova, etc., and the Soviet stands, that did not happen until late 91. So it took about 2.5 years. We're still 6 months into this movement. Things have changed. They've changed irreversibly. I was in Jordan recently, and I will answer any questions about that. The movement is slightly more peaceful than anywhere else, but I think we still expect bloodshed in different countries. Things have moved on. People have had enough, and I think there are some interesting times ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Next, we go to Dr. Abbas Milani.
Good evening. Thank you very much. My task is not to talk about the Arab Spring specifically, but to talk about how Arab Spring looks in Iran and what is Iran's impact in all of this. The Iranian regime claims that the Arab Spring is, in fact, a continued reverberation of the 1979 revolution that brought Khomeini to power. Many of Iranian Democrats believe that, in fact, the recent developments in the Arab world are a continuation of the Green Movement that began in Iran about 2 years ago. 3 million people came out in the streets in Tehran and peacefully demanded to have a legal and legitimate election. They asked, what happened to my vote? So whether it is 79, whether it is 2009, I think Iran has been a very key player in these developments. And in terms of what these developments mean for Iran, there is two schools of thought. One school of thought says that the Arab Spring is the best thing that the Iranian regime could hope for. This is the rise, further expansion of Islamism, that the Iranian regime is becoming more powerful by the day, and they're the ones who are reaping the most benefit. That's the narrative the regime would like to give as well. There is another narrative that says, in fact, the Iranian regime is very much scared of the Arab Spring. The Iranian regime is much more in line with Saudi Arabia that wants to stop the Arab Spring than it is with the democratic people of Egypt, for example, or with the democratic aspirations of Syrian people. So my sense is that while it might be too early to determine which of these two narratives is more appropriate and more accurate, my sense is that the Arab Spring is very much to the detriment of the regime in Iran, particularly if Egypt proves to be on a democratic path. In other words, Egypt, I think, is a key player. If you look at the history of the last 100 years, there have been three bellwether states in the Middle East. What has happened in these three countries has prefigured what has happened in the Middle East. Turkey, Egypt, and Iran. Almost everything that has happened, everything major that has happened, certainly has started in one of these three countries. Turkey is now already a democracy. If Egypt can go on the path of democracy, and that is a big if. We do not know what the Muslim Brotherhood is going to do. Muslim Brotherhood has promised to play nice. They keep talking the right talk and promising the right promise. But I am an Iranian. I remember what Khomeini promised in 1978. Khomeini in 1978 talked like Gandhi and then ruled like Stalin. And whether the Muslim Brotherhood's current posturing, a democratic posturing, is a genuine change of heart or whether it's tactical is going to, in my mind, be very critical in determining whether these developments benefit the Iranian regime or not. One of the second most important developments in the region for the Iranian regime is what will happen in Syria. Syria is the only ally the Iranian regime has in the Arab world. It has bought this love at an expensive price. It is estimated that Iran has given to Syria approximately $7 billion worth of free oil, money, arms, and aid in the last 25 years. So it's not a genuine love. It is a bought love, but it's a very crucial alliance. It's also a crucial alliance because it is through Syria that the Iranian regime helps Hezbollah in Lebanon. Without Syria's help, rearming Hezbollah, training Hezbollah, helping Hezbollah in Lebanon is going to be very difficult. So if Syria falls to a democratic movement, I think the future of the Iranian regime is very much bleaker than it is today. They know it. That's why they, according to fairly reliable sources, send troops into Syria, Revolutionary Guard units, to help suppress the democratic movement. The Iranian regime likes to pick and choose the Arab Spring. There are certain movements that it likes, and it supports those, and certain movement it doesn't like, it calls them Zionist and American imperialist creations. It doesn't like the movement in Syria. It claims that it's all a creation of Israel and American imperialists. It likes the movement in Bahrain. It calls it the most genuine democratic movement of the whole Arab constellation. But the regime has not been able to capitalize on these developments for, I think, two very important reasons. One, it is undergoing these days one of the most remarkable internal fractions in the history of the regime. Ahmadinejad might well be impeached. I have written a very extensive article. It's in the National Interest. You can get it online. It's available for free about these tensions and about the possibility of Ahmadinejad's impeachment. So those tensions have made the regime less capable of projecting force. The best example of how beleaguered they are is that Saudi Arabia sends 1,000 troops into Bahrain, an island 40, 50 miles off Iran's coast, a country that was till 1967, at least according to Iran, part of Iran. Saudi Arabia sends 1,000 troops to suppress the Shiites of Bahrain, and Iran does virtually nothing. It huffs and puffs, but it actually does nothing. It sends troops to Syria, but it does not send troops to Bahrain. That's partly, to a great extent, because of internal strifes, and partly because the economy is very much becoming a serious problem for the regime. The embargo is beginning to pinch. Iran is also, like the rest of the Arab world, a predominantly young population. Over 65% are under the age of 30. And over 30% minimally of this population is unemployed today. And it is a remarkably internet-savvy population. Iran has over 30 million internet users. Iran has the largest per capita number of bloggers in the world. In absolute terms, total number of bloggers, I think it is number 5 or 6. I don't know what the hell, they have so much to say. China has 1.5 billion population. India has 1.5 billion population. Iran ranks right next to India and China in terms of the number, absolute number. And per capita, Iran is number one. So Iran has these problems, and it has serious problems with its nuclear program. It has run into serious technological problems. The virus that the Israelis and the Americans collectively send into the Iranian nuclear system seems to have really done damage to it. They cannot seem to get it started. What happened in Japan has increased fears in Iran, has made concerns about that doubly more serious. And the fact that that reactor is sitting at one of the most lethal fault lines in Iran has made the idea of starting it much, much more politically sensitive. So because of these domestic travails, the regime has not been able to project as much as it would have had if it wasn't facing these. But I think on the whole, the horizon does not look well for them. Syria is critical for them. Egypt is critical for them. And Turkey is also very important. Turkey seems to be, I'll end by saying that Turkey seems to be gingerly moving away from Syria. Turkey seems to be gingerly moving away from Iran towards a much more moderate position. Till a few months ago, Turkey was Iran's biggest supporter in the international market, in the diplomatic market. A month and a half ago, Turkey hosted the biggest meeting of anti-Assad activists in Turkey, something that was not unnoticed in Iran, and the Iranian regime went after them with considerable gusto. So I think it remains to be seen what the Arab Spring does for Iran, but I think it will make the end of this regime sooner than later. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Malani. And let's go to Janet Penley.
Thank you. I'm honored to be sitting here with this illustrious panel, being just the traveler, not the expert, but I'm conflicted because there's a part of me that's delighted that I arrived in Cairo on the 28th of December, not the 28th of January. But there's the other part that I was right at the tip of the arrow. If you know the weather arrow that goes across with a storm, I was at the tip going through Egypt, Jordan, and Syria. But the part that's conflicted is, ooh, I just missed being right in the middle of it. But we were having a discussion a bit earlier before we came up. I was speaking with Noor, and being there while it was beginning to percolate, I didn't feel it. I was getting more information from people outside with the emails, are you all right? Where are you? We are hearing this is going on. I was going around and people were being people and I was not feeling it until I left. But as I was going through, I would tell people, all right, my family, I'm out of Egypt now. Okay. Now I'm out of Jordan. Well, now I'm out of Syria. But the sense that I got was that there was not a lot happening. So I was very surprised when all the news began to come out, that I was in Aswan on the 1st of January when they had the suicide bombing in Alexandria. So we heard that news, but we didn't witness what was going on. But as for how I feel about where it's going from here, I'm excited and hopeful about Egypt. I'm hopeful about Jordan because I think Jordan has always been a little more open, a little more forward-thinking. I'm really distressed about Syria. I had a wonderful visit in Syria. I got my visa before I got to the border, which I'm happy that I did because I understand that they can actually stop you if you don't have your visa. They will tell you you can get one there, but if you don't have it and it's not the day they want you to come, then you can't go there. But for Syria, I'm distressed. I'm fearful for the people that I met there. I met some wonderful people. But overall, I will go to Mara's comment, which was the overriding feeling that I got from the time that I was there is that it's really no longer about us, the U.S. These are people who are doing it for themselves. And it's their future they're thinking about, not what we think about their future. And I'm heartened by that.
Thank you, Janet. A reminder to our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're talking to a distinguished panel about the Arab Spring. We're taking questions from the audience, and one question on a card has been about the role of the economy in sparking the Arab Spring, and what is the role going forward. Of course, Tunisia's revolution was started, one can argue, by the 26-year-old street vendor Mohamed Bouazizi, who set himself on fire. There have since been a number of people who've set themselves on fire, Morocco, Iraq, and even Mauritania, a Mauritania country that often gets ignored, but yet is still a viable part of the Arab world. And if any of you would like to address this question about the role of the economy in sparking the Arab Spring and what is the role going forward, you can interpret that question any way you'd like. Anyone?
I can start if you want me to.
Yes, please, Maher.
The issue is that in these 22 countries I've been talking about earlier, years of corruption have made poverty worse for all the people, most of the people living in there. You know, you cannot be free if every day is a struggle to survive. And once you've reached that limit, you know, you can't take any more. There's this discussion in the news at the moment about the similarity, and I started alluding to this between the what's happening in the Arab world and Eastern Europe, because most of the revolutions in Eastern Europe, what happened is that people in Eastern Europe looked at Western Europe and they saw free capitalism, free market in there. And if I'm not mistaken, that's what's driven the revolutions in there. Whereas in the Arab world, if you take Egypt, Tunisia, etc., they've already had capitalism and free market. Okay. So what people are complaining about is that this free market and capitalism in there, I'm not against it, but what's happened is that it led to huge amounts of corruption. And the economies that resulted from this favored only a small percentage of the people, of the population. And this is what's happened. I think the economy is crucial to all these problems.
Anyone else want to address the question?
Watching it from outside, my sense, and reading what a lot of activists and thinkers and writers have written, to me, what has driven the Arab Spring is not the economy, but it's the question of dignity, the question of having their rights and their dignity denied. And you watch the Egyptians. I watched one of these rather remarkably eloquent Egyptian women who said, I've lived in this, in my country for 35 years. I've never voted in an election that counts. I want to be counted. I want to be a member of the 21st century. They have had enough of these corrupt, inept governments that take either the oil money or the rent that they receive from the United States, stash much of it in Swiss accounts or other places, and make out of the people, at best, rentiers of the state. The question of dignity, I think, is much, much more central. That was the question in Iran in 79. The Iranian economy was booming when they overthrew the Shah. That was the reason in 2009. I think that part of the world is waking up. I think Maher is right. It is a tectonic shift. They're saying enough is enough. You've played with us. You've denied us our dignity long enough. We want our rights.
Thank you. We have several questions from the audience related to the role of the United States in the region. And a lot of people have criticized actually the U.S.'s role in the Arab region for, in a sense, supporting these governments for so long, and in a sense tolerating the economic disparity that has, that led to the revolution, these revolutions. The U.S. on the one hand is quick to enter into Libya, but less quick to enter into Bahrain and elsewhere. Questions from the audience. One question is the United States' role in the region has been fractured. What, if any, should the U.S. role be? Another question from the audience is, what is the attitude of those in the Arab democracy movement regarding the West? So if any one of you would like to address these questions in any shape or form, please do, and maybe we'll give Noor a chance to jump in first.
I would say my personal opinion is people are too critical, at least U.S. citizens since I've been here, I've been too critical of Obama and his action or inaction in the region. What people really need to note is the people on the ground in Egypt are not, for the first time, like Dr. Abbas Milani addressed, is that they are not looking towards the outside for solutions. No longer are we looking for the cookie box cutter type of democracy, the Western type of democracy that's been spreading the last 30 years, trying to get that in Egypt. We're realizing that doesn't work. So whatever is going to work, it's going to be unique to us and to Egyptians and to the Yemenis and to the Syrians. So that if that is going to be a little bit of democracy infused with a little bit of socialism, whatever eyebrows that raise, but whatever it is, it's going to be unique to there. So what the U.S. has got to be very careful is if they play too large a role and then the people end up opposing them and the people that they tried supporting end up being banned and put in prison, as we've already seen, all their best friends are in prison right now, it will jeopardize the relationship for the years to come. And personal opinion, America is already a superpower on the decline. So they have to be very, very careful of the action they take right now. And that is to say is, again, don't leave too much. Be supportive of the people. Find the grassroots movements. The thing is, it's so difficult to find who to support. Even in Egypt itself, you have black and white. You have the pro-democracy supporters, and then you have the pro-Mubarak supporters. And one's a tiny fraction and the other's a lot more, even though you played out differently on the media. But you have, even within the pro-democracy, you have all these factions and splits. Within the Muslim Brotherhood, you have all these factions and splits. So right now, the U.S. can't, or anybody else, or even political parties within Egypt don't know who to fully support, who to put their chips on. You have to let the cookies are going to crumble for a little while longer until we start getting a true sense of who really wants what and who's fighting for what and who's really going to boost the economy. And is it foreign investments that are going to be, or is it going to be local investments? Are we going to find Arab countries, or is it going to be European? So I think it's best right now, for the first time maybe ever, for the U.S. to take a back seat. Also in the car, be in the car as it's moving, but take the back seat.
Thank you. Anyone else want to address that? If not,
yeah.
Amahar.
I think, I mean, the comment that answers this is that, to start with, that no one size fits all. That's what I said at the beginning, and it applies also to the role of the United States or the West in this. And, you know, putting politics to one side, because politics is immoral, okay? So we have to talk about what actually is happening in there, the realities for each different country. Bahrain, for example, hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet. Okay, so you cannot have something seriously happening in Bahrain. The U.S. can exert soft power or harsh power. And if you look at the two countries which changed quickly, these were the countries which were receiving large amounts of U.S. aid, Egypt and Tunisia. Libya, they had no control over. Okay, Libya, they could not exert any pressure. Yemen is complicated. Yemen has Al-Qaeda in there. So, and it's a tribal system. They intervened in Libya. Why did they not intervene in Syria? Just in case somebody asked that question. Libya is simple. Okay? Syria, it's a very difficult situation. It's not self-contained. Syria has, as Dr. Abbasi said, has alliances with Iran and with Hezbollah. If they start airstrikes in Libya, that will draw Iran, that will draw definitely Israel and Lebanon because of Hezbollah. So the situation is not as simple as how do you address the situation in one country vis-a-vis the role of the United States. I think each one has to be addressed separately.
Thank you. Let's go on to some more questions from the audience. One person has asked about the role of women in the Arab Spring. Another has asked about the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamists and the potential for them to take over some governments. If any of you would like to address the idea of what you think might be an unforeseen circumstance or an unforeseen outcome of the Arab Spring that may or may not be pleasant, maybe people haven't thought about. I mean, I know Dr. Malani talked about the Iranian revolution, and women, of course, generally speaking, were very supportive of the revolution once it happened. They were less supportive once they understood the kind of circumstances that they would be put under. Is there something happening perhaps now in this Arab Spring, ongoing Arab movements, that you can see that's equivalent to that or something that's worth considering?
I think the question of woman, for example, as you raise, is very much an important question. In some of these countries, the demise of the despot has meant the loss of rights for women. Iraq is an example. The Islamists in Iraq are not willing to abide by equality between men and women in the Constitution. It's as simple as that. They say it is against Sharia, and they're not going to abide by it. The Constitution called for equality during the despotic regimes of Saddam Hussein. Now they can't get this past the Constitution. They have sort of left this for future discussion. The other thing that I can easily imagine, and I hope I'm wrong, that could happen in Egypt is that the Muslim Brotherhood is in fact playing the card that Khomeini was playing. They are playing nice now. They claim they have undergone an ideological transformation. They do not want to enforce Sharia. They're going to abide by the laws of the land. And once they come to power, once they consolidate, they will move in that direction. That could be very much a bad news for Egyptian women and for Egyptian democracy and for the region.
Maher, yes.
Yeah, the whole thing started by a policewoman slapping Bouazizi on the face in Tunisia. So it was a policewoman who slapped him. Okay, so that triggered the whole of what's happened afterwards. The issue with the role of women in there, I think there's only one example, which is more than enough to show what's happened in the region. When I was in Jordan in April, there was a demonstration which I was watching on Al Jazeera in Jordan. The demonstration was taking place in Yemen against President Saleh. And the next day the same day he made this outrageous comment, is that women should not be demonstrating with men. So what do you expect happened the next day? There was a huge, massive demonstration with women in there, refusing or disagreeing with him on what he said and demanding basically his removal. So things have moved on forward. With respect to the Brotherhood, again, the Brotherhood is complicated because it has different roles in different countries. In Egypt, you know what? What's really exciting is that we're discussing in Egypt people jockeying for position. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood, the secular movements in there. People in Syria and Libya would cut off their arms to be in that position at the moment. Okay, they would love to be in that position. So just think of that huge leap forward that Egypt has undertaken. Okay, they're not worried about it. They're talking about the date. They're arguing about the date for the elections. Just imagine this happening in Libya or Syria. That'd be a wonderful thing to happen. So the Muslim Brotherhood may be playing a role in there, but if you look back at the days of Nasser, okay, at the days of Nasser, to eliminate the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, there were some agreements between Nasser and the party, the biggest party at the time, which is called Al-Wafd Party. Okay? Sorry, I'm mistaken this. Going back. To eliminate the role of the Wafd Party, the Muslim Brotherhood were talking to Nasser to postpone whatever reforms they were talking about. Now, it's the seculars who are talking to the current government to try and postpone the elections. Things have changed a bit. Okay? They're scared about the Muslim Brotherhood. But, you know, that's a fantastic thing. Okay. At least they're discussing a transition to democracy. It doesn't matter, okay, who wins or who loses, but at least we've moved a step forward. There is no going back on that. So the Muslim Brotherhood, I think they're not scary. Okay. Don't be scared of them. We're not worried about them. I think there are other movements people can be scared about, but not the Muslim Brotherhood.
Let's go to Janet, and then we'll go to Noor. Janet.
Yes, but I have also just recently read that a lot of the young women who were instrumental in the demonstrations in Egypt have been excluded from the discussions on where we go from here. So we're not there yet by any stretch of the imagination. It's a long, long way to go.
Yes, Noor.
So two things. The first, to go to the Muslim Brotherhood, like I think he ended, is when you truly do your homework, and I think most people on the ground are the ones who only really truly know, is that the Muslim Brotherhood don't pose a genuine threat. Why? Is because the Muslim Brotherhood don't have a loyal support. How they always get their support is because the government has ostracized 85% of the population living below, 70% living below the poverty line, 69% illiterate. They have ostracized most of the population. Who has been there, right there to fall on when the government's been turning their back to them is the Muslim Brotherhood. And how have they been doing it? Through charitable solutions, hospitals, mosques, schools, centers, clinics, all of that. So that's how. So the moment once they have a better option, the people will drop the Muslim Brotherhood like a hot potato. So I just want to let people know that, too, to not be too worried. It's not a genuine support. And now, second thing, in terms of feminism, we are in the supposed third wave feminism right now that we're in. And the solution, if I may, and please, absolutely no offense, but like you said, 29.7, that was the ceiling age of people on the ground, the demographics there. So in Egypt and most of these countries, please, no offense whatsoever, but the panelists right here would not be consistent, sorry, it would be people under 29.7 years of age. I'm being completely honest. I apologize. But that is it. People don't want to look to the older generation so much. And I think now where we want to guarantee women more rights in every sense of the word is it's going to start from the youth again. Because who are the women in the square? It's, again, nobody over 27 years of age. So it's going to come within the people. And again, say here in the States, how can you start teaching just more rights or in just developing countries? It's got to start from a human thing in the family. Of course, economic policies, political and social, but Islam and stuff, you have the Islamic edict as well as you go by the new constitution that we're forming right now, as well as the old, the 1976, all of those, you do have women's rights in there. It's just we need the right lawyers to defend those. So all the stipulations are there. It just needs to be embedded in people's minds from a young age. So I think it's going to start off with the youth and hopefully with the years to come. But some say I'm an optimist, so we'll see.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're talking to a distinguished panel about the Arab Spring. Among the questions from the audience is one actually directed to Noor. Noor, you mentioned at the outset that you realized that you could be more valuable here in the United States than in Egypt. The audience member would like you to elaborate on that, please. And I think it dovetails from your comments about youth in Egypt. And we have another question about the technology and the internet and how that may have played into the Arab Spring. Can you maybe mix those two together in your answer?
I'll try real quick. So basically, like I said, I left 2 days before the revolution. It killed me so hard. And my roommate's over there. He's Egyptian. I also have two friends visiting from Egypt right now. So if you have any questions, you can shoot from them. They're fresh off the ground. They smell like Egypt still. We had 2 days after the revolution happened. Then my friend and I, school just started, University of San Francisco. I never felt so helpless in my life. My entire family there, I've always been politically active in Egypt, or just socially, always trying to push with the grassroots movements. I'm a firm believer in civic engagement and participation, and that's what we need for social progression in Egypt. So I started really questioning. We kept looking at tickets every night. We stopped even going to school. We were staying up because a 10-hour difference from 12 at night, that's when our day started, till 7 in the morning. That's when Tahrir sit-ins and everything was happening. Then we were like, let's go back to Egypt. Then after a couple of days, 3-4 days started happening, we found ourselves calling our parents and informing them. We started calling our friends and informing them of what's going on. So we started realizing we have all the resources over here. While in Egypt there's communication, there's gaps, massive gaps in the communication networks happening in Egypt. So we said we can do it here. And I'm a firm believer also too is in developing countries for true change to come about, the international community needs to shed light on it. That's how Egypt, if Al Jazeera camera was not there, Tahrir, the whole movement could have been in jeopardy. So when the world's eyes are on it, that's when I think it really happens. So then we started seeing, well, then maybe we can be the Western world's, or we can be the eyes into Egypt for the Western world. Example, us sitting up here and talking about it too, to just give you insight to what's going on. So my friend and I started a student solidarity group in school. We helped organize the 8,000-person protest downtown here. We did panels and lectures at our school, UC Berkeley. We just, literally, it was a full-time job. Like I said, the revolution employed us. Then to move on, our most recent thing that we've been knee-deep in right now, which has been really, really interesting, is we got together with a group of programmers and web developers and all this in just a bunch of volunteers at Stanford through their Liberation Technology Department. And then we started throwing out a bunch of our project ideas. Was basically how we can create technological tools or help with the fluidity of it within the country to help bring about democracy. Think about it as democracy 2.0. And we threw out 10 different projects, and the top two and one that we both voted on was to create a website to crowdsource the Egyptian constitution. Crowdsourcing meaning everybody comes together and a place, one set place for people to come and talk about it, vote on it, make amendments, changes, think why not. Like basically a public forum, a discussion to start talking about it. Lived in Egypt for 22 years, I never heard the word constitution coming out of someone's mouth. So we were working on this thing in Stanford, and it was just gonna be for us, then we were gonna push it. And then, out of nowhere, a coalition of Egyptian NGOs approached us. Mohammed al-Baradai, his media campaign manager, approached us and asked us, can we help them do this website? We said, awesome. We had a bunch of nerds from Stanford who loved this stuff. And they all knew exactly what they were doing, and we were a cultural bridge to that. And we have the website up. The hard launch happened about 4 or 5 days ago. Already 10,000 votes on it, about 80,000 just view passerbys, 10,000 likes on Facebook. So it's really gaining momentum. So I think technology is a great way to help alleviate a lot of the conflict in Egypt.
Applause from the audience, and then rightfully so. Anyone else would on the panel would like to address that question of technology or anything else? If not, I certainly have other questions. One actually relates to the media. Noor, you mentioned Al Jazeera. Their English streaming, they English stream their live stream their broadcast, so people in the United States and anywhere can get it if they have a web connection. Today, they showed the courtroom trials of two former Egyptian ministers. One is the former minister of information, which for Egyptians is a stunning turn of events to have someone who, according to Al Jazeera, helped orchestrate the suppression of information is now being shown on TV, being charged in a lot of ways. But can anyone on the panel talk about the role of the media in the revolution and how it might actually continue or not help to help ongoing events? Anyone? Dr. Milani, perhaps?
You know, the green movement in Iran in 2009 was called the first Twitter revolution. And that, of course, helped Twitter stocks. One of our students, one of our graduate students, is trying to, in fact, study precisely how much actually people were using Twitter, because Twitter has now made it available. You can go and check all the uses. Because of that development, the project that Noor was referring to is a multidisciplinary project at Stanford called Liberation Technologies. And they now are turning what was essentially a seminar, what began as a seminar, into a full-fledged program. They're hiring a program manager for it because they're realizing that in many of these places, that is the way to break the hold of these regimes have a hold on information, and if you can unlock that hold, you can do a great deal. In Iran, one of the most important things that Iranian Democrats ask people outside to help with is to break the regime's monopoly, to break the control of the internet that usually these regimes control. In Iran, the entire infrastructure of information is controlled by the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards. State Department has just put in some $50 million to help precisely develop technologies to bypass censorship, to bypass these filtering mechanisms, these mobile internet servers that are being sent to the Middle East are precisely in recognition of the truly liberating role these technologies can play.
Can I just add a
comment? Yes, please, Mahar, yes.
Yeah, I mean, well, one thing is that the most of these social medias of networks, etc., what they have done is actually they've increased the transparency of information coming out in the Middle East. And that's very good. I mean, I look at pages from Libya and Syria, and some of the information is actually fantastic. You wouldn't see it on the news. People, and you could hear it or see it within 30 seconds of it happening. But the other thing I wanted to comment about is Al Jazeera, and that's an interesting one, Al Jazeera, because the West hate Al Jazeera. Most of the Western countries, they don't like it. Most of the Arab world's, most Arab governments, they hate it. Okay? Israel hates it. Everybody hates Al Jazeera. So if everybody hates it, they must be doing something correct or something right. And
sorry. More applause from the audience. We are coming down to the last few questions. We have one question asking how the Arab Spring might impact the Israeli-Palestine issue. And, of course, President Obama talked about that during the presidential campaign here, about how important that was to the greater Middle East, and then the Arab Spring happens, and other events, of course, happen. So that's one question perhaps we can address in the closing moments. Another question springs from my own mind, and that is the revolutions that have happened in the Arab world in history. Of course, there have been many revolutions, including the revolution to overthrow French colonialism in the 1960s, which effectively got rid of the colonial powers. It took a lot of work. A lot of deaths happened. This period of what now 50 years ago seems very remote, but yet there might be lessons there for what's happening in the Arab world today. If any of you want to address these questions or actually have final thoughts on what has been talked about today, you're more than welcome to jump in. We have just a few moments. Anyone? And they're looking at each other too, politely.
On the last issues, I mean, I could comment about what's happened in Jordan vis-à-vis the Israel-Palestinian problems. Israel had nothing whatsoever to do with the uprisings. Okay, I was asked this question recently when I gave a talk at the Middle Eastern Forum, and I said they're innocent. They had nothing to do with it. Okay, the problems were people were looking for better employment prospects, cutting food and fuel prices, end corruption, electoral reforms. These were the major things what people were asking for. Of course, as time goes along, there are lots of people who are tagging on. And, of course, the Israeli issue comes to prominence then. People want to some Arab countries like Egypt and Jordan to negate the peace treaties they have with Israel. I mean, again, it's wonderful that people are coming out in the open and talking about these things. Okay? They have a platform to talk about it, which is a good thing. I don't think Israel is a main issue in this, and I think it will not be a main issue in this. People have tried to utilize it in Syria. They tried to utilize it to deflect attention from their problems by sending demonstrations to the border into the Golan Heights and from Lebanon via Hezbollah, I would imagine. I don't know who organized this, or Iran might have been responsible for this. So I don't think Israel has anything to do with this. But if you just take, switch the clock back a bit, go back a bit, had Israel signed these peace treaties with democratically elected governments, okay, this is utopia we're talking about, nobody would be mentioning this, okay? But they have not. They have signed these treaties with governments which, in certain instances, they are despotic, they're corrupt. They had a different reason for signing it, but it was not endorsed by democratically elected parliaments. And I think we still have to look to the future to see what will happen with this. As a firing shot, just to finish with that, I always think of what I mentioned this earlier when Gorbachev visited Germany in 1989 to try and to convince Honecker to leave. There was a very good saying by his speaker at the time, Gennady Gerasimov, who said, he who does not listen or does not do something like this will be punished for life. Okay? Governments have to listen in the Middle East because they will be accountable. They can't last forever. And the thing has moved on irreversibly.
Thanks, Maher. We're going to... Dr. Malani, would you like to...
Well, I think there's no doubt that there has to be a just and equitable solution to the Arab-Israeli problem. But all of these revolutions that have happened in Egypt and Tunisia and Yemen, they have shown that the problem of these people, contrary to what their despotic regimes claimed for many years, wasn't just the Arab-Israeli problem. Their problems are domestic. Their main problem is democracy at home. It is the despotic regimes that still rule in that area that would like to deflect attention from their own corruption and their own incompetence and say that that is the end-all of all problems. That problem needs to be solved, but that's not going to end the problems in the Middle East. The problems of the Middle East will be solved by the generation that is sitting at the end of the table and
you're referring to me.
And their optimism and their global vision and their non-ideological, truly empirical view of the world. Our generation was befuddled with ideology. This generation is truly a non-ideological, pragmatic generation, and the future belongs to them, and it will be a great future.
We'll get to that future in Nora in a few moments, but let's go to Janet Penley, please.
I just wanted to say, and the rest of us old fogies, what we can do is support the newers of the world.
Well, Nora Ahmadine, that's a lot of pressure on you and others, but can you address these compliments that have been directed your way, and really, on a more serious note, about the future and how you've talked about how it's not a overnight process; it's going to take a while. But can you just address that again, perhaps in closing?
Yeah. If my friends can stand up, please just stand up. This is the people. This is the naive. We're supposedly naive, but all of us, every single one of our parents approached us and kind of shy and embarrassed a little bit because they're like, I'm embarrassed that my generation couldn't do something like this. I'm so happy that you guys finally summed up the courage to do something like this. So now it stands as it's mostly the, you can sit back down. And it's mostly now is you have the older people are the ones who have the capital. They're the ones who have the know-how. We are still young. A lot of us are still uneducated, although very liberal and progressive, still uneducated. And the older, now it's about finding the right balance between the youth and the older generation. We can't ostracize either one of the or. We got to be able to sit at a round table all together and all be able to talk about that. So I guess naivety is, if that's how you say it, naivety is working in our favor, I guess.
Thank you. Our thanks to Noor Ahmadine, Maher Khaleji, Dr. Abbas Milani, and Janet Penley for their comments here today. Thank you to the audience as well for your questions. Thank you to the listening audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.